This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is Jonathan Eig, the author of King a Life. King a Life is the first full biography of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King written in decades and the first to include recently declassified FBI files. Eig's work mixes revelatory and exhaustive new research with brisk and accessible storytelling to forge the definitive life for our times. In this revelatory new portrait of the preacher and activist who shook the world, the best-selling biography gives us an intimate view of the courageous and often emotionally troubled human being who demanded peaceful protest for his movement but was rarely at peace with himself. He casts fresh light on the King's family origins as well as MLK's complex relationships with his wife, his father, and with fellow activists. King reveals a minister wrestling with his own human frailties and dark moods, a citizen hunted by his own government, and a man determined to fight for justice, even if it proved to be a fight to the death. In this landmark biography, Eig gives us an MLK for our times, a deep thinker, a brilliant strategist, a perplexing husband and father, and a committed radical who led one of history's greatest movements and whose demands for racial and economic justice remain as urgent today as they were in his lifetime. Jonathan Eig is a former senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal. He is the author of several books, including highly acclaimed bestsellers Ali, A Life, Luckiest Man, The Life and Death of Lou Gehrig, and Opening Day, The Story of Jackie Robinson's First Season. Jonathan Eig, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks again for taking the time to talk today. And I want to start our conversation with what is probably going to be a pretty complicated question. Your previous work focused on figures from the world of sports, Lou Gehrig, Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali. What made you want to tackle a life of someone like Dr. King?
Well, you forgot that I also wrote books about Al Capone and the inventors of the birth control pill. Okay. So I was never completely focused on sports. In fact, my career as a journalist was never in sports. So I love sports, and I've tried to strike a nice balance between sports books and other books. And but I have to confess, having said that, that it was the Muhammad Ali book that led me to King, because I was interviewing people like Dick Gregory and Harry Belafonte, Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young, people who knew Ali. And just out of curiosity, I interviewed all of them in person and I spent quite a bit of time in their homes in some cases. And I just started asking them, what was Martin Luther King Jr. like? Because I was curious. And King and Ali overlapped a little bit. They met twice, and their stories certainly overlap in terms of their opposition to the Vietnam War, among other things. But I just realized I had this unbelievable opportunity to sit with people who knew King and to ask, what was he really like as a man? And, you know, we've turned him into a national holiday and a monument in Washington, and almost turned him into a Hallmark card, it feels like at times. And I realized that I would be given a great gift if I did nothing but just travel the country interviewing people who knew King, and that what an opportunity that would be for me personally. And then if I could also get a book out of it and share what I learned with other people, that would be a great use of my time.
And you know, we should also point out it's a moment that's going to be past us pretty soon, right? I mean, some of the people who knew him are not going to be with us for a very much longer. This is also an interesting moment to reconsider King. There seems to be part of my post-pandemic reading has been to kind of go back and study King. There's recently a volume that came out that considers the political thought of Dr. King. He's also a very prominently featured in a book that kind of takes him into more of a Marxist humanist, Dr. King. And I think one of the things I admire so much about your book is the way that there seems to be a threat. And you said we've sort of almost turned him into a kind of a secular saint. And at the same time, I also think that there's this threat risk, maybe, that King is starting to fracture. People are reading into his message the things that they want to read into his message because he's such an appealing figure to try to do that. And you've reassembled that. I know this is, I should have asked you this to begin with, but if you have your copy of the book handy, there's a passage on page 557 that I think speaks to some of this. I was wondering if you could read that first full paragraph.
Page 557, on my most recent junior memorial in Washington, D.C., in the spring of 2022, I found none of King's books for sale in the gift shop. Our simplified celebration of King comes at it saps the strength of his philosophical and intellectual contributions. It undercuts his power to inspire change. Even after Americans elected a black man as president, and after that president, Barack Obama, placed a bust of King in the Oval Office, the nation remains racked with racism, ethno-nationalism, cultural division, residential and educational segregation, economic inequality, violence, and a fading sense of hope that government or anyone will ever fix those problems.
Yeah, so that part of the inspiration here as well?
It's frustrating to those of us who care about history to see it being misused and to see King being, King's words being used to support the NRA, for example, or to support, military invasions or to attack affirmative action, right? You can find a quote for any purpose, and King is being misused by people on all political sides, from every issue. He's also being used to sell, you know, laundry detergent and high-end luxury automobiles. So, I wanted to try to return King's agency to make us hear his words again and understand what really mattered to him again, because I feel like it's one of those side effects, you know, and it's a great thing that we celebrate him. It's a great thing that we teach kids about him in kindergarten. It's a great thing that we honor him with a holiday every year, but sometimes we don't get much beyond that kindergarten lesson, and we don't assign people to read his books. At most, we might assign, I think my kids have been assigned to read The Letter from Birmingham Jail in school, but nothing beyond that. And I think that's not really fair to what he was trying to say.
No, in some ways, it's heartbreaking in that vignette that you start that passage with, that the idea that none of his works are for sale at the memorial is just, it's stunning. I had the chance to spend some time with Where Do We Go From Here prior to this interview, and anyone who wants to really approach King, I think, needs to look at that book just to get a sense of, you know, obviously the heroism comes out in, as you say, all of those kindergarten lessons that we still hang on to, but the heartbreak that exists in that work is truly moving.
Well, King was obviously much more radical than we like to teach our children today. As Harry Belafonte pointed out to me, we don't like to teach radicalism because we want to make everybody comfortable. But King was a radical long before he began fading in popularity. He was a radical from the beginning, because that's because he believed Jesus was a radical and he was trying to follow the teachings of the Bible. So we do him a disservice when we try to water him down all of our images that we'd like to have of him.
Yeah, even when it's well intentioned and we're trying to do something positive, I actually believe that and again, that's, I think your book makes an important contribution to this moment where people are reconsidering his message and trying to reframe it for our contemporary times. So this book is a really rich and layered biography of this extraordinarily complex person living through this extraordinary moment. And there are so many different ways that we could talk about this and enter into this conversation. But I'd like to focus on some of the relationships that are highlighted in that opening passage that I was talking about. One of the most complicated, I think, is his relationship to his father, or as we call him here, Daddy King. So tell us a little bit about what you learned about not only his Daddy King, but also about his family of origin.
It's difficult to trace the King family back, as it is for many African-American families, because slave names often weren't recorded. They were seen as property, and the government tax collectors and census takers didn't care. But I was able to trace the Kings back some further than some have. And I was able to see where they worked as sharecroppers, who they worked for as sharecroppers. And Daddy King's story is really an extraordinary one. I mean, we should be writing operas and plays about Daddy King, because he comes from this family of sharecroppers. His father has basically been beaten down by the system, has turned to violence and alcohol. His mother remains faithful to God and a true believer in church every Sunday. And Daddy King is the one who at the age of 12 decides he's got to do something different. He's got to get out. He's almost illiterate, and he just starts walking toward Atlanta, takes a job at a railroad, teaches himself to read and write, starts preaching at a very early age, because that's one of the few jobs that that Black people at that point could have, where they had some control of their own destiny, and marries into this also very religious family. It gives him a chance to become eventually the pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, one of Atlanta's biggest churches. So King grows up in this really, Martin Luther King Jr., grows up in this extraordinary family that has, in just a very short time, pushed itself. Daddy King in particular has really lifted himself out of these abject circumstances into a life of opportunity for his son. And of course, that makes him, puts a lot of pressure on young ML, as they call him, to live up to his father's expectations. And that push and pull, that relationship between Daddy King and MLK, is a fascinating one, and it's a complicated, difficult relationship from beginning to end.
Yeah, and because even throughout the entire civil rights movement, you had, again, Daddy King really almost trying to protect his son from some of the dangers that he was facing by putting himself in front of the movement.
You know, one of the things that really surprised me, I found an unpublished autobiography of Daddy King, something he wrote before his published autobiography, and it included the transcripts of his interviews for that autobiography. And he really says over and over that he didn't want his boys to become preachers. He wanted them to choose something more stable, to make some money. And then once they, not surprisingly, defied him and went in, they both went into the priest business, into the pastor business. He urged ML over and over again to get out of this leadership role in the movement, that he was putting his life at risk. He was putting his family's life at risk. Daddy King goes to Montgomery after ML's house is bombed and says, "You're coming home with me." And Martin and Coretta, to her credit, both say, "No, we're not. We're staying here."
Yeah, it's a fascinating, the two of them obviously struggled with each other, right? I mean, there was a deep and abiding love there, but at the same time, kind of a power struggle in a sense. And that also leads to another really complicated relationship having to do with his wife, Coretta Scott. In the epilogue, you paint this incredibly poignant image of the blue suitcase, right? That sits under the bed containing the letters written to her by King. And we don't know what's in those letters. There's a part of me that hopes we never find out. Probably some things that are best left private. At the same time, you know, obviously the historian or the academic in me would certainly like to delve through those things to find out things. What can you tell us a little bit about King's relationship to his wife?
Yeah, let me just say that the blue suitcase is my white whale. I will continue hunting it as long as I can, but we don't know where it is. Those are the believed to have a suitcase believed to contain all of the personal letters from Martin to Coretta. But one of the I really worked very hard in this book to try to create a full portrait, a more multidimensional portrait of Coretta, because she hasn't received a really great biography yet. She's told her own story a couple of times, but she's fascinating and she's so important. And I think the reason Martin falls in love with Coretta is because she has experience as an activist, because she has this passion to really be involved, to really work in the fight for justice and racial equality. And yet, because of the way Martin Luther King Jr. is raised and because of the expectations he has around gender roles, she never really gets the chance. And she's obsessively frustrated by that. She begs him time and again, I want to do more. I don't need to be home with the kids all the time. Other people can help out with the kids. I want to be with you. I want to be protesting. I want to be putting my boots on the ground and going to jail if necessary. And Martin won't have it. He wants her home. He thinks that's her role and that's what the kids need most. And at the same time, he's not being faithful to her. And she, in my opinion, absolutely knows it. And that's another source of enormous tension. And then when the FBI starts using his sex life to try to destroy the marriage, destroy his reputation, she's got to stand up for him. She's got to, you know, she has his back all the way. There's never a moment of doubt as far as I can tell.
In her role as trying to protect.
Yeah. She, even to her dying day, refused to admit that there was any kind of adultery going on that him all the way, despite, you know, enormous evidence to the contrary.
So that leads to another theme in this book that terribly comfortable even talking about. And it has to do with King's other intimate relationships. But I think the more important thing, and you highlight this, I think importantly, is the recently declassified FBI files that were really part of an ongoing project to not merely to discredit Dr. King, but really to destroy him. I mean, you said to destroy his marriage, but really they were trying to compel him to commit suicide. And again, the shock of the, and shock is probably the wrong word, because can any of us really be shocked about some of the things that our government has done? But the part on page 397, you talk about the journalists who are given this information refused to use it. And no one questioned that the FBI was collecting this information.
Right. And I want to be careful here, because I try to judge people by the standards in which they lived at the time. I don't want to apply 2023 standards to what we expect journalists to do. But I do believe that journalists had an opportunity and a responsibility to report what they knew about the FBI's campaign against King. And I worked hard in this book to be fair and honest and to describe the true nature of King's, you know, marriage and his extramarital affairs. But at all times, I was conscious of the fact that what really matters about King's extramarital affairs is how they were weaponized by the FBI in a campaign to destroy him. And that campaign had nothing to do with the fear that he was a communist, even though that's how Hoover liked to portray it. It was largely a function of racism, the threat that a Black man might lead the Black community into a situation where they demanded real change was frightening to J. Edgar Hoover, and not just J. Edgar Hoover, because the white media, as I said, made that possible. Many members of Congress knew exactly what was going on. These documents were shared with members of Congress, and perhaps most importantly, they were shared in enormous detail with LBJ, who not only was aware of it, but sanctioned it, and in some cases, I believe, encouraged it.
So, and that sort of leads to another question. Let's talk a little bit about his relationship to LBJ. As you said, he was aware of what the FBI was doing. At some point, he tried to keep kind of, according to your book, tried to keep his kind of arm's length distance from it, asking that the letters be put into a file by, or a vault right by his secretary.
Right, but there was no arm's length at all, actually. LBJ was wallowing in this information. He was enjoying it, according to people who knew him, that he liked getting this salacious material, almost, you know, viewed it as titillating, I think. And to be able to laugh with the boys about, you know, King's sexual behavior, you know, it's gossip of the worst kind, and it's pernicious and it's racist. And you'd like to think that LBJ would have recognized that King was a very important ally to him. LBJ said that the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act were, you know, his greatest accomplishments, that his work toward achieving civil rights and making America a more just society was what he was most proud of, and that who helped him more in that than Martin Luther King. He could not have done it without King, and yet he did not appreciate that or respect King enough to shut down J. Edgar Hoover, or at least to say, I don't want to see this stuff. That would not have taken a great moral act of courage for him to do that. But he's getting, and this is something I discovered at the LBJ library in files of LBJ's secretary and his liaison to the FBI, Mildred Stiegel, that he was getting upwards of one or two memos a week, personal memos. This is not just something that he was CC'd on. These were letters directly from J. Edgar Hoover to LBJ, and that he was looking at the majority of them and filing them away in his safe because he knew that they were sensitive.
It's astonishing. That more than anything else, these files, whatever they may reveal about Dr. King, they say really something much more profound about our government and the misuse of power at the highest levels of our government. But at the same time, this effort had its effects, right? So talk to us a little bit about the kinds of strains that this put on Dr. King.
Well, first of all, it absolutely damaged the relationship between King and LBJ, which may have been, you know, the greatest, most influential relationship between an activist and a president in American history. And when LBJ takes office, and we can hear his phone calls, they're recorded and they're available. We can all listen to them online. He calls him Martin, and there's this very warm relationship that you, in the tone of their voice, in the way they relate. And over the months and years ahead, that changes. That becomes icier. It becomes more formal. And Martin is now Dr. King. And that has an impact, and it had an even, perhaps even more profound impact on King's mental health. He felt enormous strain as he spoke out more aggressively, not just about the Vietnam War, but about Northern poverty and Northern racism and segregation. He felt under pressure from all sides, and he knew that he was destroying his relationship with what was left of his relationship with LBJ by attacking LBJ's war in Vietnam. And he did it anyway, because he knew, he felt it at his core, that this was the right thing to do, that this is what, you know, his beliefs, his religious beliefs in particular, commanded him to do. So that took a toll. You've got the FBI trying to destroy your marriage. Every morning he woke up wondering whether the newspaper was going today, some reporter who had the tapes, who had the transcripts, any day, any newspaper in the country could have made the decision to publish that. And he woke up every morning wondering if this was the day that somebody published the story that he knew the FBI was spreading about him.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, and it's just remarkable. And again, you describe in really harrowing detail the stresses that this put on him. And the effects that this had, not just on his message and his relationship, but as you say, on his mental health and his physical health. I was wondering if you could just, you know, describe a little bit of that to us.
You know, it was surprising to me just how obvious it was. It's been sitting there for all of us to see, but perhaps because biographers 25, 30 years ago weren't as keyed in on issues of mental health. They didn't notice how many times Coretta in her memoir uses the word depression, uses the word exhaustion, uses the word anxiety. You didn't notice that people like Andrew Young and others were saying that, you know, King started to drink more heavily. And, you know, for example, how obvious is it that when he gets the news that he's won the Nobel Peace Prize, where does he get the news? He's in the hospital. He's there for exhaustion, as they call it at the time. But now we would probably call it depression. And he actually lets the reporters come and interview him in the hospital, in his hospital bed. So he wasn't trying to hide it. And in the transcripts of the of his phone calls, you know, his phones were tapped. His advisor's phones were tapped. We have a lot of transcripts of these conversations. And one of the things that's really stunning to me and that often gets overlooked is how often he talks about his need for a vacation, how he really doesn't want to come back from when he is on vacation. Even when he's in the hospital, he asks whether he can, somebody could help talk to his doctors to let him stay longer. So he's clearly under just enormous strain, as anyone would be in that position. But, you know, he's human, and we forget that sometimes.
To our detriment.
Right.
We forget that. One of the other important contributions that I think this book makes is that it brings to life this moment in American history that I think some people may not know or even want to know. The stories concerning the depth of racial hatred that King confronted are almost too depressingly varied to describe. But there is a single episode that I want you to talk about that I think highlights so much of both the absurdity that people were willing to go through. Tell us about Montgomery's Oak Park.
Oh, man. So we know all about the Montgomery bus boycotts, of course, and we know that, you know, the people of Montgomery rallied and united and overcame enormous obstacles to force the city to integrate its buses. And they were trying to think about what to do next. You know, how do we continue this push in Montgomery? How do we make sure we keep the, you know, our foot on the gas and force the city to do more? And they consider an effort to integrate parks their next their next effort. And throughout the South, there was enormous segregation and enormous inequality in the city park systems and in state park systems. You know, there were more parks for white people than there were for Black people. The white parks had more amenities than the parks for Black people. There were swimming pools and tennis courts in the white parks. There were zoos in the white parks, and the Black parks tended to be, you know, a swing set if you were lucky. So the people of Montgomery, while King was now traveling more nationally and wasn't as deeply involved, the people of Montgomery decided to try to integrate the park systems. And City Park in particular was this jewel. It had this fabulous zoo. It had swimming pools. It had, it was, you know, designed by Frederick Law Olmsted. It was one of the greatest parks in America. And the city shut it down rather than integrate it. They fenced it off, and they killed the animals, the zoo animals. They drained the pools. They let weeds grow across it. That's how adamant they were that they were not going to allow this uprising to continue. They were not going to, you know, Black people might have succeeded in getting the buses integrated, but that's, they're not getting anything else out of it. If they think this is going to become a city that integrates, they got another thing coming. And that was a powerful lesson. And it wasn't just Montgomery. We see this happen in other cities. And eventually we also start to see schools shutting down, cities and counties shutting down public schools rather than integrate their schools.
Again, it sounds naive to be astonished by it, but at the same time, there's something about that image of, you know, killing the animals in the zoo and paving over this, as you said, it's a jewel for the entire community rather than see it integrated. Just, it speaks volumes to, you know, to obviously to the race relations that were live at the time.
Yeah, we sometimes forget, and it's easy to forget, just how much was at stake. You know, white people had this stranglehold on power. They had these, you know, unbelievable opportunities and advantages, in large part because they were able to cast the Black community into a subordinate position. It made for cheap labor. It made for, lower taxes, all kinds of things. Letting go of that, you know, and that's how they viewed it. They viewed integration of the buses or integration of the schools as a crack that was going to destroy, eventually cause their whole system to come tumbling down.
Yeah. And again, and so they, you know, talk about, you know, cutting off your nose to spite your face. They just, you know, they didn't have the zoo any longer. They didn't have that park any longer. It's just so, and there are so many stories like this that are contained in this work, and also stories about so many different relationships with figures like A. Philip Randolph, Stokely Carmichael, Malcolm X, just to name a few. Is there any one that stands out to you from your work that we should discuss in some more detail? I know you covered some things about his relationship to Malcolm X that I don't think are as widely known as they might be.
Right. One of the interesting things about King to me is that he really does not like conflict. He's the leader of a protest movement who doesn't like conflict. And that just tells you so much about him. But in all of these relationships with people who were, he sometimes had trouble with, you know, he loved A. Philip Randolph, but he had trouble with Roy Wilkins. He had trouble with Stokely Carmichael. He didn't agree with them always, but he was always looking for common ground. He wanted to work with all of these people. I can't think of a single person where he just sort of stubbornly or angrily said, no, that guy, I'm not returning his calls. He engaged with everybody. And the relationship with Malcolm is one that we really have misunderstood. And I discovered proof of just how the media, I was going to say the white media, but it wasn't just the white media, because Alex Haley, the Black writer, was involved in this particular scandal. But the media was distorting and trying to stoke controversy and create conflict between these two men. So King and Malcolm only met once. Malcolm did go to Selma once to try to see King. King was in jail at the time, and Malcolm saw Coretta and had a good meeting with her. But when, after Malcolm's assassination, it was before the assassination, Playboy interviewed, Alex Haley, writing for Playboy, interviewed King for what I believe was the longest interview King ever gave. It was, at least 5,000-6,000 words long. And in that interview, and this is a famous quote, it's taught in African-American history classes around the country. King says he disagrees strongly with Malcolm's approach, that violence is never the way. And people who rely on stoking hate to achieve racial progress or going about it wrong. So I was able to track down the Alex Haley's transcripts for that interview. And King didn't say that. He said that in regard to the Nation of Islam. The question was, what do you think of the Nation of Islam? And he said, I disagree with groups that stoke violence, that think that violence is the way to force change. And they changed to make that quote read as if it were a response to a question about Malcolm X. And when asked about Malcolm X, King was actually much more open-minded. He said he looked forward to getting to know Malcolm more and that he thought that they had things in common. So a lot of people, and Peniel Joseph has written nicely on this, and so did James Baldwin, for that matter, a long time ago, said that King and Malcolm were a lot more alike by the time they reached the ends of their lives. They had more in common than they had separating them. And I think that history has borne that out, that they were both moving in the same direction. They were probably moving toward a potential meeting of the minds where they would have found that they were effective partners if they had had the chance.
Although, again, still in the popular imaginary, there's that perception that they were in some ways antagonistic to one another. And especially, I think, in your book, that the vignette that you describe where King meets with Coretta Scott is just a very touching episode.
They were antagonistic sometimes. I mean, Malcolm definitely used King as a foil and, criticized him for trying to work with a white leadership, white power structure that was never going to really be open to true progress. But at the same time, this meeting, as you've made mention, Malcolm says to Coretta very, cleverly, let Dr. King know that I'm out there as a target, that, they can really hate me and maybe that'll make them more inclined to work with your husband.
Yeah, it's really an astonishing moment. So we have to start to wrap up. But before I let you go, I want to ask a final question. We've already discussed to some degree Dr. King's legacy, but why is this important today? And I'm curious as well, what effect has spending this much time with the man had on you personally?
Wow, good question. I feel like we need to hear King's voice again. Certainly, he was warning us about so much that we see in our society today, so much that remains problematic. There's still so much racial division. There's still so much segregation. There's still so much inequality. We still have the police brutality that he complained about in his March on Washington speech, a line that we often don't remember. So I think
a lot of lines from that speech that we don't remember.
Yes, that is true. Please read the first half of that speech, right? But we need to hear his voice again, and certainly we'll find that he has much to teach us today. That's partly why I wanted to write this book. And I guess for me, how this experience changed me, I don't think I've ever spent this much time with somebody who was so deeply committed to his core beliefs, who was willing to walk that walk. I mean, Muhammad Ali was a truly inspiring hero, and he absolutely was willing to sacrifice everything for his beliefs. But King, over and over again, not only stepped up, but stepped up farther and farther. Every time he could have paused, he could have allowed someone else to come in for him, to move the ball to the next marker. Instead, he just risked more and more. He was absolutely not perfect, but so committed to his core beliefs and so really inspiring in that he believed that we could change. He never lost hope. And man, he had a lot of reason to lose hope, but I don't believe he ever did.
No, again, and that's, I think, one of the beautiful things that your book does and why I'm glad that we have it now at this point in our history, is because you've, in a lot of ways, sort of restored his humanity. Again, it's easy to think about the inspiration, right? It's easy to think about the compelling words that he offered. It's much more difficult to often grapple with the depths of despair that sometimes those things came from.
Absolutely. And I think he can inspire us and move us more if we think of him as a human being, and if we can relate somehow to what he went through. And I think we can and should try to do that.
So again, the book is due out next week, correct?
Yeah, May 16th.
All right. So we'll be looking for it. I just received my hard copy today.
Oh, good.
I'm very excited to get that today. Once again, I want to thank you for your time. And again, really thank you for this work. I think it's a beautiful book, and it speaks so much to this present moment. So with much appreciation.
Thank you. It's nice talking to you.
Once again, my guest today has been Jonathan Eig, the author of King, A Life, due out on May 16th from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. My name is Tom DeSena, and you are listening to the New Books Network.